when Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and proclaim his message in their cities. When John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who wear soft robes are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet, this is the one about whom it is written, 'See, I am sending my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' Truly I tell you, among those born of women, no one has arisen greater than John the Baptist, yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John came, and if you are willing to accept it, he is Elijah who is to come. Let anyone with ears listen. But to what will I compare this generation? It's like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to one another, 'We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We wailed, and you did not mourn.' For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Please be seated. Earlier today in Istanbul, a Syriac congregation has gathered with candles and incense, spectacular robes, liturgical art. If I recall correctly, worshiping in Syriac, Aramaic, and Turkish. After worship, hundreds of Syrian Christians will gather over coffee and pastries in their fellowship hall, the one time in the week when they can all celebrate their common faith and their common heritage together. It's one of the oldest forms of Christian worship still alive in the world. In an open-air church in the Thai countryside, a pastor will, or has, preached and led worship for a congregation of 30 people or so. And if you were to visit, it would remind you of a Southern Presbyterian worship service from 40 or 50 years ago. Except for one thing, the pastor leads the hymns with an electric guitar. Last night, I expect my dad and stepmom were among the 2,000 people at their church's Saturday evening service. The church has five services. The Saturday evening service draws about 2,000. Altogether, they draw 7,500. Professional level rock band, right? PowerPoint accompanying the hymns and the sermon. And a light show, not like here where sometimes they dim the lights, but, you know, theater lighting and all of that. I haven't been there, but I'm told that in Atlanta, one church has four separate congregations meeting simultaneously in four different locations, but one pastor delivers the sermon in all four locations by hologram. And I'm told that if you visit one of these churches, you won't know whether he's actually there or not. And then I'm mindful of a storefront African-American Pentecostal church in Cleveland. They gather. There's a worship time that's published, but who knows when it'll start. They pray, they sing, they shout, they dance. It could last 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. Right? five congregations at worship, vastly diverse in culture, in theology, and in worship expression, not one of them looking very much like what we're doing here at Holy Trinity. And may I ask you, which among these churches hosts authentic ministry? In which congregations would we see true signs of God at work? Which congregations are home, to use Jesus' words, which of these congregations are home to true wisdom? Well, in Matthew, John the Baptist, having announced earlier that Jesus was the coming one, now sits in prison, and he sends his disciples with a question for Jesus. Now, in John's world, of course, prison doesn't mean a three-month sentence and then you're out. Prison is there to intimidate, to inflict pain, to control, to kill people. So when you're in prison, you don't expect ever to go home. And John knows all that, so he sends his disciples with their question for Jesus: are you the coming one? Or should we wait for someone else? We wish we could know what leads John to ask this question. Countless preachers, I'm sure, have provided thousands of different answers. But Matthew simply tells us that John is in prison. He's heard what Jesus is doing, and he asks, are you the one? Really? We know John's question. It's not so much for many of us that we're questioning Jesus. That's not our big problem. But we look around and we see so many presentations of Jesus, so many representations of Jesus, that we, like John, want to see authentic ministry. We want to experience the reign of God breaking out around us. We want to be a part of that. So we want to know, by what signs do we recognize authentic ministry? There's this fear out there in churches that faithful, authentic ministry is doomed. That being faithful to Christ will chase people away because they want bells and whistles, clever Facebook pages, and better coffee. And so people are asking whether they need to compromise their sense of ministry in order to attract people. And a few years ago, I was teaching at a meeting of pastors. They had broken them up into little groups of six or seven round tables. What's your name? Where do you serve? What's it like? And in this group of six or seven pastors where I sat, one really stood out. She said, well, my congregation's growing. And she sounded apologetic. Like a kid who wins the Garden Club Award but doesn't want to be seen carrying it around that day, you know? What happens with the fear that authentic ministry might not have anything to do with outreach and growth? In that sense, John's question is our question. One of our friends swears by a contemporary worship service. Another says small group ministry is where it's at. Another finds Christ by participating in Habitat for Humanity, building homes for folks who otherwise couldn't afford them. So what are the true signs? A big, growing church? Dynamic worship services? New members? Really cool youth spelunking trips? How do you know when you see authentic ministry at work? And we hear these conversations. I hear them here at Holy Trinity. People do agonize when they move to a new town where they'll worship. They grow restless in their own congregations, and they grow curious about others. They received mixed messages from one venue or another about what church should be like. And in that sense, John's question does sound familiar. How do we recognize authentic ministry, and what are its true signs? Jesus' answer is simple and direct. The blind see. The lame walk. Lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear. The dead are raised, and good news goes out to the poor. Healing. Life, liberation. Where we encounter wholeness and vitality, authentic ministry is on the move. Wisdom, Jesus later says, is vindicated by her deeds. It's such a simple answer, though it seems we Christians often try to complicate it. We get caught up sometimes in theological debates and worship styles, healing, life, liberation, wholeness, vitality, the signs that God is truly on the move. I like to call it Jesus' blessing agenda. And for our visitors, you may not know that many in the congregation have committed to read the Gospel of Matthew through this season of Lent, from beginning to end. So I invite you, as you read Matthew through this Lenten season, look for it. Look for this blessing agenda. What does it look like? Jesus and his disciples travel from village to village, announcing good news and performing acts of healing. They gather community, they eat a lot, and they bless people. And yes, if you notice, Jesus passes on some harsh words for some people. But if you pay attention while you're reading Matthew, the harsh words are only for those who think they are superior or righteous. Not once does Jesus start an obscure theological debate. Not once does he tell a sinner they ought to straighten up, or a sick or demon-possessed person they ought to try harder. Jesus' agenda is all about blessing people who need blessing. Wisdom, he says, vindicated by her deeds. If we look around in the life of this congregation, we can see some of those true signs, the blessing agenda on the move. Many of you participate in the breakfast fellowship where Trinity members feed and worship with people who need a good meal and a safe place, a sense of community in a pretty harsh world. And so here at Holy Trinity, we advertise worship at 8:30 and 11 o'clock, but we have a third worship service in the breakfast fellowship every Sunday where community is being built and the Word of God, good news, is being proclaimed and shared. It's like a third worship service. And if you just visit, you'll sense the Spirit on the move, wisdom vindicated by her deeds. In a recent class of our Academy for Lay Ministry, I asked permission to share this. I saw it at work. One of our more courageous members, let's just say he's a few years beyond retirement, shared something very personal. We were asking, how is it that you receive and experience love? Is it through kind words? Is it when someone performs a helpful deed for you? Is it through a gift? And this person said, you know what? At my stage in life, how I really experience love is through touch. And after the class, I observed as a woman in the class who happened to be married gave this man a pretty spectacular hug. I was looking for the reaction on her husband's face. He seemed cool with it. But I thought at that moment, isn't that it? Wisdom vindicated by her deeds. And long before I came to Holy Trinity, I'd met people and heard that sometimes people join this congregation so they can participate in the music ministry. And if you visit here long, you'll know that our organist, Peter Brown, combines classical music, traditional hymns, and fresh liturgical pieces. And so if you stay here a while, you'll hear a variety of excellent music. But if you really pay attention, you'll see something else going on. Over time, you'll hear diverse voices from within the congregation. You'll observe choir members giving care to one another and inviting other people to come along. You'll see children, as we just did, expressing their gifts and finding blessing here. And so it's not just over time pretty music we see. We have that in abundance. It's music ministry, wisdom vindicated by her deeds. When people actively give care to one another, when we find ourselves lingering a little longer after classes and worship to visit, when we give ourselves in ministry within and beyond the boundaries of this congregation, you just look around, we perceive the true signs. We perceive wisdom at work, vindicated by her deeds. And so it may be more simple than we'd like to admit, Jesus' answer. It's clear and direct, at least, this blessing agenda, where we find healing, life, liberation. That's where God is at work. Just look around. You'll see it. But of course, it's also Lent. So I can't stop there. It's Lent. It's not a season simply for simplicity. It's the season for reflection and honesty, for sort of a sobering assessment of ourselves and the world. During Lent, we remind ourselves that Jesus' ministry is costly, that Jesus encounters outright resistance. John languishes in prison. Accusations fly. In Lent, we remember that Jesus' ministry provokes resistance. We remind ourselves that resistance can come from outside. Many of us remember Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous "I Have a Dream" speech from the March on Washington, but perhaps the work that best reveals King's distinctive approach is his letter from a Birmingham jail. In a city where black people couldn't find decent jobs and where many restaurants and public facilities were closed to African Americans, King and his colleagues demonstrated in the streets. And if you've seen the picture of children being beaten back with high-pressure water hoses and dogs stretching their leashes to bite young African American men, well, that's Birmingham. And in that process, King found himself in jail. Well, where did he meet resistance? Obviously, we remember the racist sheriff, Bull Connor, and the segregationist Birmingham administration. But beyond them, 8 white ministers, 7 Christian pastors and 1 rabbi, published a document called A Call for Unity, and they asked King to settle down, get off the streets, and wait for justice. We remember what King said. He suggested that the greatest obstacle to freedom lay not in the fanatical racist, but in the peace-loving white moderate. None of those in the room. Who, in King's words, paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. And who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. The gospel of freedom, King called it, good news to the poor and cleansing for lepers, never lacks for opponents, though wisdom, Jesus reminds us, is vindicated by her deeds. May we remember that not long ago, a well-known public commentator told us not to come attend Lutheran churches. Did you hear that? He didn't say exactly that. What he said was, we ought to avoid social justice churches. So I went to the Lutheran website, and I've been to the Disciples website, and the Presbyterian website, and the Episcopal website, and the Roman Catholic website, and the Met. They're all social justice churches. Did you know that? In a special tab, maybe he would learn something by visiting the websites of the churches. But true ministry rarely arrives unhindered. It's an odd thing about Jesus' own ministry. He takes sides. Jesus takes sides. The righteous complain that Jesus eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners. Well, Jesus says, I didn't come for the righteous. Jesus says in our passage, the poor hear the good news. Indeed. Obviously, Jesus travels everywhere. He speaks to everyone. But in Jesus' ministry, systems of power and privilege, even systems of righteousness, have no place. So resistance to the gospel can come from outside, but somehow the gospel challenges us as well within. For gospel can be inconvenient, messy, demanding. When the blind see, they might just perceive my own hypocrisy. When the deaf hear, perhaps they'll overhear my casual grumbling. When the lame walk, perhaps they'll get ahead of me at Stouffer's or claim my attention in church. We recall that in Matthew, it's the rich young man who falls just short of the realm of heaven because he can't part with what he has. In his classic book, The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis depicts a man who enters the afterlife with a hideous red lizard on his shoulder. And in order to move into heaven, the man must part with the lizard. But he's afraid. He knows he can't make it into heaven with the lizard, but the thought of parting with it terrifies him almost as much. Will this man, unable or unwilling, find a way to part with the lizard, or will he choose hell? The gospel, sometimes it seems, sparks that kind of resistance within us. And so during Lent, the season of assessment and reflection, we have to be honest. Jesus' ministry does spark resistance. One day, John's disciples will return to Jesus, and they'll bear the news of John's execution by Herod. And in John's fate, Jesus will see his own. Thousands have flocked to John beside the Jordan, but Herod has locked him up and will behead him. Crowds chase Jesus through the countryside as his ministry brings healing and joy to many, but at the same time, others are plotting to kill him. So it's time to be honest. Wisdom is vindicated by her deeds, but it is hard to be neutral with the gospel. Authentic ministry invites all of us. All of us are invited to participate in this blessing agenda. So I invite you to take another look at the gospel lesson that we just read this morning. And the reason I'm inviting you to do that is to take a look at verse 1, because most Bible translations put a paragraph division after it or separate it off from the rest of the passage. But I think it's crucial, because Jesus' disciples have just gone off on mission. And they're doing the same ministry that Jesus is about. Jesus has sent his disciples to preach and heal, just as he's doing, to participate in the same acts, in the same process, in the same ministry in which he's engaged. This wisdom is going to be vindicated by its deeds through them. And so this invitation comes to us that ministry is not just done by Jesus, not just done by professional clergy, not just done by a few special volunteers. Research demonstrates that there's a vital connection between members' participation in a church's ministries and congregational vitality. Where churches are highly involved in ministries of justice, healing, and community outreach, guess what? Congregational vitality soars. When members attend worship consistently, when they participate in study and growth groups, when they volunteer in a congregation's several ministries, congregations thrive. Authentic ministry invites us not simply to attend and give, but as we're able, to participate in the living, vibrant body of Christ. Seems to me that churches have so many odd conversations. How do we get this group or that group to come to church? How do we reach youth or young adults or professionals or our neighborhood? All these conversations may have the question backward. For it is we, all of us, who are invited into authentic ministry. When we demonstrate care, when we get involved in healing, when we take ownership of the blessing agenda, then Jesus' words come alive in us. And we might think about getting it right. It's not first about attracting other people, though I am a Southern Baptist by background. But if we want to experience Jesus' words alive among us, we have to respond to the invitation Jesus sets forth, this blessing agenda. Friends, we want, desperately long, to see God. It's a longing that runs deep within us, to see God on the move, to see things getting done, to see wholeness and participated, to see God setting things aright. We long for that. Last Sunday, my friend Julie O'Brien spoke in the adult forum on the Kentucky writer Wendell Berry and his novel Jaber Crow. I had invited Julia to speak in forum, and I said, you know, who would you like to talk about? And she said, Wendell Berry. I emailed her back, have you read Jaber Crow? She said, well, that's my favorite novel, and came in. In that novel, a small town in Kentucky learns that one of its sons has perished in Vietnam. And Jaber Crow has to dig the grave and then fill it up. And that gives him time to reflect. For a while again, I couldn't pray. I didn't dare to. In the most secret place of my soul, I wanted to beg the Lord to reveal himself in power. I wanted to tell him that it was time for his coming. If there was anything at all to what he promised, why didn't he come in glory with angels and lay hands on the hurt children and awaken the dead soldiers and restore the burned villages and the blasted and poisoned land? Why not? Having thought more about it, Jaber reflects, God must forbear to reveal his power and glory by presenting himself as himself. Those who wish to see him must see him in the poor, the hungry, the hurt, the wordless creatures, the groaning and travailing beautiful world. True signs, true wisdom. When we see people finding life, building community, we know that God is at work. When the poor find empowerment and folks save a seat for the lepers, that is Jesus' home. It's not necessarily complicated. It's a blessing agenda, and we happen to be, thank God, invited. Wisdom vindicated by her deeds. Friends, hear and believe the gospel. Amen.